Mr. Conan, Dragon Slayer. The best I ever made. It's beautiful. But I never had the nerve to use it.
Any difference. What you want to kill isn't flesh and blood.
It'll bleed off.
How do you know? No one so much as even scratched it.
She's right. I'll need the amulet.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. This isn't your standard film review, rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with a little bit of background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of the plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend and give us a favorable review. This month, we kick off a new year with some cinematic fun and a new theme as the LSCE delves into what we're calling Here There Be Dragons. That's our salute to some scaly celluloid antics, and this week we get the ball rolling as we screen 1981's cult dark fantasy classic, Dragon Slayer. Join us! In my junior year of college, I discovered, by way of my advisor, that by sheer coincidence, based on the number of classes I had already taken in the social sciences, that if I took a cartography class, and then I took a digital satellite mapping class, I would just happen to have stumbled my way into earning a geography minor. Now, let's be clear, I didn't care at all about geography. Quite frankly, I'm rather lousy at creating maps. Scale is always what got me, and math was never my strong suit. But I did have a decent ability to recreate images that I would see of territory by way of the history lectures that I attended, and I'd be able to really freehand borders and outlines to show geopolitics across various eras. Thus, I would end up going on to take a grueling semester of cartography, where I would prove to be a seeming disappointment to the professor who oversaw all of my work. Because, as he quickly surmised, and he wasn't wrong, I was not there out of my genuine love of taking elevation readings and surveying topography. A standout moment did occur where I went to turn in a map that I had been working on that basically was the layout of the bridge that we have here on campus that connects our school's quad to the main plaza outside of our student union and library. And he took a little moment to look at the offering, and then he dryly commented, "Mr. Roberts, I suggest you get into the habit of putting Hic Sunt Draconis on all of your future submissions, because with the way you have scaled this map, I have no idea what I'm looking at." Now, I know, in my heart of hearts, that he was being a dick. And yes, he most assuredly was. Rotten hell, you crusty old bastard. But that comment that he delivered just so succinctly, it tickled me so much as a history nerd. I couldn't help but grin. Now, for the record, the phrase itself is completely historically inaccurate. It's part of an urban legend that the Western world has really bought into, only actually existing on a single example of a map. It was a warning that showed up on a 1510 CE Hunt Lennox globe, which was something apocryphally attributed to multiple maps shown, where they would have a section of uncharted sea and they would stick the phrase there. You've seen it before, I'm sure. In looking at old prints of old maps of the ocean or other regions of the world, they would simply fill in the empty spaces with images of sea monsters and other sorts of horrors that would embody a big stretch of emptiness, the implacable unknown. And often, the phrase, rendered in Latin, was a warning to all those who would dare try to traverse that area. Hic sunt dracones. Here there be dragons. But I ask you, what's not to love about dragons? They were my gateway into an abiding love of dinosaurs, after all, and prehistoric life in general as a kid. My father once went on a business trip, and he came back with two small Imperial toy brand dragons. One, a brown, winged horn chap, and the other one was this green underwater specimen. And from there, I was completely hooked. I would go on to bigger and better things, of course. Literally. Because, honestly, if you enjoy dragons and dinosaurs, the next logical step has to be you mainlighting some 100% pure kaiju hijinks with Godzilla, Gamera, and other such fantastic beasts. The behavior? Yeah, might be it was weird, but it was still within the realm of, air quotes, normal for a boy in the 1980s. Or rather, this was one of my more normal phases growing up, and I was further encouraged by my various relations, and that led to other dragon-related coolness. Case in point, I was obsessed with watching the classic Rankin and Bass animated The Hobbit, and the main reason for me? Smaug the Dragon. Yeah, you zoomers and you snowflakes, you can keep your CGI Benedict Cumberbatch monstrosity. I gotta tell you, my Smaug, that has Richard Boone's killer pipes, and he looks vaguely cat-like. Which, by the way, I gotta say, the man can lay out a rap that is so hardcore gangster, I think he has an official invite from both the Crips and the Bloods, and would join up in a heartbeat. But hey, you don't have to take my word for it. You be the judge.
Be done with your riddles! What else brought you, Lake Man?
Revenge!
Revenge?
Surely you must realize that your success has made you some bitter enemies.
Revenge! You! Ha! I am Smaug! I kill what I wish! I am strong! 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 My armor is like tenfold shields. My teeth are like swords. My claws, spears, the shock of my tail, are thunderbolts. My wings are hurricanes. And my breath. Are your riddles now?
But truthfully, that doesn't get to the crux of this week's film, for which I have my maternal uncles to thank for. Picture it. It's 1989. I'm in first grade, and I'm staying over at my maternal grandparents for the weekend, and that just happens to be when my Uncle Bob and my Uncle Tim are coming over to visit and just have dinner with the family. I happen to be sitting in the living room, playing with my Masters of the Universe toys and goofing around, when Uncle Bob comes into the room, and by way of channel surfing, as the adult, you know, you hand over the remote immediately, he ends up landing on the Saturday matinee WFLD. And lo and behold, Dragon Slayer is put forth front and center. It felt like before I could blink, I was sandwiched on the couch between him and my Uncle Tim, who seemed to appear just out of nowhere, somehow with just a bunch of grape and orange soda and chips in a bowl with dip. It just happened. They materialized. A can for each of us, both of them raving that, "Chris, you're gonna love this. This is a good movie." And in spite of my grandmother's protest from the kitchen to make sure they're not showing me anything scary, I got to spend a really cool afternoon eating junk food and taking in an amazingly fun movie with my two goofball uncles cheering me on. This is something that sort of happened on the regular back in the day. And I got to see some mind-blowing action involving a young wizard in training battling a cantankerous worm bent on controlling a kingdom. Truly, it remains to be a rather cherished memory of mine. But it was only the start of my romance with the movie Dragon Slayer. I would end up watching it multiple times over the course of that year, going so far as to make up my own, and I must stress, very poorly drawn comic book version, which I of course brought to school and showed off to anybody who was willing to give me the time of day. Dragon Slayer was a hit at my house, until, like so many things, it fell off my radar and just became a film that I would recall fondly, but would not revisit until years later, long into when I was in high school and started getting into VHS collecting for myself, looking back for films to add to my growing vault. That's when my love of the movie came flooding back yet again. But if you're gonna get to the heart of Dragon Slayer, you have to first look at the era in which it was created, and you have to start off with a trio of very talented people that came together to make it. I'm talking about, of course, Hal Barwood, Matthew Robbins, and one, Phil Tippett. Let's start from the start. Hal Barwood was an avid film enthusiast. Born in New Hampshire, he would eventually make his way west to study film at the fabled USC, where he struck up friendships with fellow film students George Lucas, Walter Murch, and John Milius. Barwood would end up going on to work on Lucas's first film, a big screen adaptation of his dystopic student project, Electronic Labyrinth THX-1138-4EB, which would eventually become 1971's shortened THX-1138, which ended up starring Robert Duvall and Donald Pleasence. The film didn't do so hot at the box office, but Barwood ended up striking up a friendship with a mutual acquaintance of Walter Murch's, a young Texan who came by the name of Matthew Robbins. Robbins got his start in the mid-1970s, finishing up first a degree at Johns Hopkins University with Murch before going on to attend at USC to study film as well. Once he and Barwood hit it off, another mutual friend of theirs, Steven Spielberg, who had just recently convinced Richard Zanuck and David Brown to let him adapt a true story of a young Texas couple who were on the run from the law, become his first feature-length film, he had tapped the duo into penning that screenplay in what would ultimately become 1974's amazing crime drama, The Sugarland Express. Something that would star Ben Johnson, Goldie Hawn, and William Atherton. A minor theatrical success, it quickly became a cult favorite, but more importantly, it got both Barwood and Robbins noticed, especially when they won the Best Screenplay at the 1974 Cannes Film Festival. Now, they actually had some street cred to launch projects of their own. And yeah, Spielberg, I mean, really, he just moved on to make some minor films. I don't know, I think of one about some sort of big fish or something that bothered a small New England town, but I digress. Together, Barwood and Robbins would continue to go on and partner up, hoping to write a project that they themselves could eventually direct and produce. But in the meantime, they followed up the success of Sugarland Express with 1976's Motown-backed sports comedy, The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, which starred James Earl Jones, Billy Dee Williams, and Richard Pryor, which in itself was actually a financial success. And then they came off of that doing the 1977 biopic MacArthur, with Gregory Peck starring as the controversial general. And of course, last but not least, another favorite of mine, 1978's Corvette Summer, starring a young Mark Hamill and Annie Potts running around Las Vegas in search of a stolen hot rod. It too was financially successful. And what's more, Robbins would get to direct the picture himself. Convinced that they could go on and continue to make their dream project, Robbins and Barwood struggled to find a way to get their perceived cinematic romantic comedy up on the big screen. But here's the problem. They didn't find any takers. I guess their version of romantic comedy was just de rigueur. So in 1979, they did what any driven, logical set of creatives do. They went with their backup plan. Robbins and Barwood had shared the same dream. If they couldn't make romantic comedy, they wanted to, of course, make the next best thing. A memorable cinematic dragon that they could throw up on the big screen. Inspired by the classic fable of St. George and the Dragon, which, I have to say, truth be told, the classic 1984 Little Brown Margaret Hodges edition with its gorgeous artwork by Trina Shart Hyman, a cherished gift from my Aunt Jude, it sits about a foot to my left as I'm recording this entire episode. That's exactly what the writers wanted to craft, to show an epic struggle between the forces of good and an animal that was just the pure embodiment of fantasy evil. We're not just talking about some fantastic animal here. No, we're talking about a realistic villain. One that just happened to be a fantasy creature who was about, I don't know, 40 feet long and had a 90-foot wingspan. And due to the various cinematic contacts they had access to, by way of friends like Spielberg and Lucas, they had cutting-edge technology and talent that existed to them by way of a newly minted special effects company called Industrial Light and Magic. All of the sudden, a pitch like this, one about a movie that had an evil dragon terrorizing a dark age Northern Britain, it wasn't so far-fetched. So, they hired a storyboard artist who would lay everything out. They claimed that such a feat could be accomplished for just a small, paltry donation of $18 million, and suddenly Paramount Pictures answered the call and agreed that they would pony up the money to greenlight the project, now tentatively dubbed Dragon Slayer. What's more, Robbins would be allowed to direct the project himself. Now, all they needed for their film was an appropriate hero. Enter Peter McNichol. Robbins had first met Peter McNichol through recommendations from a casting director. The young Texas native had been so excited to test his stage training in areas like stage combat and horseback riding that once he was cast as the sorcerer's apprentice Galen Bradwarden, he was quickly challenged instead with learning magic tricks, sleight of hand, and juggling, in addition to taking on challenges and starring in a fantasy-slash-period piece. The late, great Caitlin Clark, taken from us far too soon, was cast as his love interest, Valerian, the daughter of the local blacksmith in the town of Swanscombe who masquerades as a boy to avoid being offered up as a victim for the beast. This marked Clark's first foray into making pictures, having earned her stripes already and starring in a host of Broadway plays before this. Classic Shakespearean actor Sir Ralph Richardson was selected to play the role of the sorcerer Ulrich of Craganmore. The perfect bit of casting for this story, if you ask me. Interestingly enough, though, you have here, starring as an early Christian priest, Brother Jacobus, Ian McDiarmid, Emperor Palpatine himself. Throw in Peter Airey as the Craven King, Cassiodorus, John Hallman as Tyrion, the murderous captain of the guard, and the always fun Sidney Bromley. You may recall he played the character Angiwook in The Neverending Story as the loyal but put upon caretaker Hodge, and what you really have here is a hell of a cast. Production would kick off in the summer of 1980, starting with filming in Northern Wales to get the established rolling countryside, villages, and castles there. And then you had the filmed climactic finale being completed in Skye, Scotland, before finishing up any of the other shots and expansive interiors in the famous Pinewood Studios back in Britain proper. But, as you would expect, the most important casting decision would be how they would translate their ideal villain, the dragon Vermithrax Pejorative, up onto the silver screen. Oh, I have to say, sidebar here. Vermithrax Pejorative is Latin, and it basically translates into the worm of Thrace that makes things worse. And in the novelization, it is explained that Vermithrax was spawned in Thrace. That's the historical area that's to the west of Macedonia on the Balkan Peninsula, which, if you're going to talk about modern-day geography, that would be parts of Bulgaria, Greece, and the thin strip of land that belongs to Turkey. But geographical backstory aside, how do you have such a fantastic creature for a story that needs to be grounded in a veneer of reality? The answer comes twofold. First, you look to ancient lizards of the past, dinosaurs, to get your base model. And then, you follow that up by hiring the extraordinary talent of one Phil Tippett. Now, for the thunder lizard aspect of this, we once again return to our old friend Ramphorhynchus. You may recall we talked extensively about Ramphorhynchus back when we covered the 1970s-tastic kaiju classic, The Legend of Dinosaurs and Monster Birds, an old-school pterosaur who darkened the skies of the early Jurassic period. It just makes good sense. It's the perfect model for a fantasy creature, like a dragon, to be based upon. You have a very real vertebrate mammal who has a membranous wings fixed to its front arms and long, veined tail. It's perfect. You can build a dragon's body off of that same frame with some familiar embellishments. Four limbs, long wings that you can attach to the creature's forelimbs, with a trailing tail to give the beast some balance. Bulk up the musculature, and while at the same time you keep the frame light, just what you need to give a real feel for flight, and then you swap the head out with something that's more akin to a crocodile, rather than the needle-like mouthed fishing teeth that you have of the actual reptile. The jaw action can be swapped out and modeled on modified faces to emulate that of a snake to allow the creature to be able to hyperextend its lower jaw in a hinge-like movement, which becomes perfect for breathing a gout of directed dragon fire on camera, all while maintaining a very realistic feel. All of that said, that's just the first part. The second factor comes with having a certain brilliant modeling artist who's tapped to design your dragon. A gentleman who answered to the name of Tippett. Now, if you don't know the name Phil Tippett, but you consider yourself to be a regular goer of the movies, I'm going to say this. Shame on you. The man is a genius, and I'm going to go out on a limb and make the claim that he has revolutionized model work and puppetry in the medium of film. I mean, let's face it. He worked on Star Wars, this film, Indiana Jones, Howard the Duck, RoboCop, Willow, Jurassic Park, Coneheads, Starship Troopers. The list goes on. He's got the bona fides. And truly, he acted as the Ray Harryhausen of his generation, which I'm going to admit is a weird thing to say because both of those men were alive at the same time. In fact, this film was released the same summer that Ray Harryhausen's final film came out, Clash of the Titans, and while I do indeed love that picture, this is clearly the better movie from a technical perspective. Tippett ended up creating a creature that was grounded in reality. He focused on having the dragon's talons made to emulate the claws on what you would see on a chicken's foot, which I know, yeah, that sounds bonkers, but when you get a lot of shots of a dragon's talons grabbing folks up in a film, you need to make it look real. And real they do look. They crowned their creation with a set of curved horns, they created wings that were designed to emulate those of a bat's, and they made forelimbs that ended with six, count them, six clawed fingers, just for a bit of panache. There was a problem though. During this design phase for Vermithrax, while Robbins and Barwood did indeed have Tippett on board, they had to respect that he had contractual obligations to make another film simultaneously. You know, just a small minor offering, a little picture called The Empire Strikes Back. Fortunately for them, Tippett ended up assigning the ILM special effects artist by the name of Brian Johnson to tag in, and he loaned him out, as well as the legendary special effects guru Dennis Muren, having proven himself on both the original Star Wars film and Alien, and they also brought on board a young artist named Ken Ralston to join in the project. And before the smoke had cleared, they had assembled a dragon team that was tasked with creating the effects for both Dragon Slayer, as well as, in their part-time, focusing on getting the movie magic effects for a little film called Raiders of the Lost Ark completed. Now, all of this design was viewed as a positive, but Paramount was starting to get second thoughts on the film's budget. Now, they would hold to their commitment to funding the picture. $18 million was promised, $18 million would be delivered, but it was becoming clear that this was going to be costly, and in an effort to offset production costs, Paramount ended up striking a side deal with Walt Disney, trying to take advantage of having their Imagineering production team come in to be used by ILM to help create the full-scale replicas of the dragon, based on the final maquette that was created by Tippett, under the watchful eye of both Johnston and Ralston, of course. Now, something else you need to understand, I did say this cost $18 million. 25% of the film's budget alone was put into just creating the dragon. And for their efforts, when Disney joined the fray, they were responsible for creating the following. A 16-foot dragon head and neck that ended up resting on a combination crane and gimbal, which would be moved by hydraulic controls. A 30-foot section of both dragon wing and arm. A gigantic clawed talon that would be used for close-ups when picking up human victims. A 20-foot length of film-ready dragon tail. Three full-size dragonette puppets for the villain's surly offspring, and one full-size dragon corpse that would be shown after the climactic end battle. Disney would go on to utilize sound stages at Pinewood Studios in Great Britain to further create the fiery cavern that would serve as Vermithrax's lair, with a large mock-up of the beast placed right in the middle of the set. The baby dragons, dubbed the Dragonettes, were created to be an unsettling balance of both ugly and alien-looking, purposely trying to make the audience find them grotesque so that viewers would not feel sympathy for the creatures when they met their final end. Hence why such attention to detail was taken to show them reveling in gore and feasting on victims when they were encountered. For Vermithrax herself, it was originally planned that 13 different puppeteers would be utilized to attempt to bring the massive reptile to life, But in spite of the blatant fact that the engineers had created a very realistic-looking dragon, none of them who were brought to the fold had formal training as puppeteers, and that severely hampered the efforts of bringing the beast to life on the silver screen. And this is where production started to bottom out and where director Robbins began to panic. You see, all of the beautiful art direction and all the design in the world can't counter for the fact that you have a poorly executed dragon on screen, and anything other than that just comes off looking like an ill-performed puppet that cost millions of dollars. Robbins was unable to get the shots he needed, so to cover for this, he opted to use static, out-of-focus B-roll shots of the dragon's head, which was used to cover for the main unit not working. Production would lag, and tongues started to wag that they were saddled with a bomb. Dennis Muren, for his part, blamed the hired crew, noting that instead of having the ILM designers come in and have actual puppeteers be utilized, Dragon Slayer was instead being turned over to a bunch of engineers who were British and were just day players. They were in no way trained puppeteers. How else could they actually control and simulate a beast for such a fantasy film? The short-term workaround? Well, what they did was create an insanely detailed hand puppet, which would be filmed as a stand-in for the film's big villain unit, and it was operated by a crew of only selected puppeteers, the kind that could accommodate for specific articulation, close-up shots, and most importantly, would not accidentally melt the puppet when the flamethrower special effects were brought in. For all of their innovation, though, they still had one real main problem. They needed their villain to move, and the stop-motion effects of the day were just not cutting it. Muren and Tippett racked themselves with trying to come up with ways they could successfully animate Vermithrax and her full-body movements, trying first to do traditional stop-motion animation, and then, in desperation when that did not seem to work, they tried to use a Muppet-style puppet that would be shot against blue screen, and nothing came out looking realistic. In desperation, Tippett resorted to a technique that he had recently used when filming The Empire Strikes Back, when he was going to try to animate the rod puppets in the respective shots that would show Luke Skywalker and Han Solo riding those bipedal animals, the Tauntauns, and then later he would use the same technique to animate the fluid gait of the AT-ATs. Look, Gen Xers, I'm going to tell you this now. It's a fucking acronym, and you should know that. You can call it an AT-AT all you want, but it's always going to be an all-terrain armored transport to me. And I'm going to throw this out. You don't call an AT-ST an AT-SIST. No, you don't. That's ridiculous. So, check yourself, alright? I digress. So rather than moving a puppet when filming with in-between exposed shots, which is traditional stop motion, Tippett would make his movement and then snap the photo during the exposure phase, just not when the camera itself snapped shut. So noting this, what happened was it created a blurring effect, which made the actual model move in a very fluid manner. Tippett timed this by hooking up his model to a set of controlled rods that were run by precise motors attached to a computer-commanded protocol program, and then he would just basically hit a button and run it. And what would happen was, the entire animated sequence would be recorded, creating what seemed to be a seamless form of animation that would remove all of the classic herky-jerky effects that you would see with old-school stop-motion. And instead, it brought the animal to life in a very fluid style. In short, he created an entirely new filming technique, dubbed Go Motion. A large armature of Vermithrax was created and placed in an advanced cradle, which was controlled by computer-operated rods and shot against a blue screen, using Tippett's newly dubbed Go Motion as a technique, and it brought to life one of the most lifelike dragons the silver screen had ever seen to date. It looked amazing, flying, walking, attacking its victims, and while the rods that controlled the armature were actually able to be seen by the cameras, they would be rotoscoped out of the frame in post-production to hide their very existence, and a cinematic legend was born. Folks, truly, I could guess on more, but really, you've been ever so patient. So why don't I stop my yapping, and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
I have been witness to something. Something of consequence to you.
To me?
There's a great task needing to be done.
No doubt you've heard of our trouble at home.
A dragon. Fire and stench. It is evil. Pure and simple.
You want me to do battle with that?
Behold, for I am chosen. I shall die that many may live.
Twice each year, the king selects a new victim. Chosen by lot. Girls. Virgins.
Your king has made a pact with a monster.
But your children were dying.
Only a few. Does that sound cruel?
Blacksmith, have you ever forged a weapon?
An edge like no other on this earth.
We open on the wizard, Ulric of Craganmore, as played by Ralph Richardson, preparing himself to meet with a delegation that he has already foreseen heading his way from the distant realm of Erland. Looking into his scrying bowl, he is horrified to witness the fires and horrors that a great beast is unleashing upon a kingdom. While his faithful servant Hodge, as played by Sidney Bromley, attempts to turn the delegation away, Ulric beckons his apprentice Galen, as played by Peter McNichol, to let them in and to give them the audience they seek. Once inside the castle, Valerian, as played by Caitlin Clark, attempts to inform the mystic of their situation, but the wizard explains that he already knows their plight, and he comments on what troubles dragons can actually bring.
Welcome to Craganmore. I'm Ulric. Which of you men calls himself Valerian?
We are here on behalf...
I know why you are here. You're a delegation from Urland, which is beyond Delvesia. Let's see the artifact.
Scales.
How did you come by these?
I found them at the mouth of the lair.
What else?
A claw.
That's no claw, by the gods. It's a tooth. You want me to do battle with that?
Who else can we turn to?
Did you try the Meridid sisters? What about Rimbaud? I heard tell he killed a dragon once.
They're all dead. You are the only one left.
There's a long way to Erland.
Twice each year, at the spring and autumn equinox, the king selects a new victim. Virgins.
A lottery. Barbaric. And in return, this dragon, it leaves your villages and crops unburned. Your king's made a pact with a monster.
Master, don't you think that...
Silence.
Are you afraid of dragons?
No. In fact, if it weren't for sorcerers, there wouldn't be any dragons. Once the skies were dotted with them. Magnificent horned backs, leathern wings, soaring in their hot breath wind. I know this creature of yours?
Vermis rex pejorative.
Look at these scales, these ridges. When a dragon gets this old, it knows nothing but pain, constant pain. He grows decrepit, crippled, pitiful, spiteful.
Ehrlich agrees to help the delegation, much to the concern of both Galen and Hodge, who worry about their master's ability to weather such a long journey. As the group prepares to leave Kraganmoor, Captain Tyrion, as played by John Hallam, arrives with a small cadre of Erlin's royal guards to test the sorcerer to confirm he has actual abilities before he possibly puts the entire kingdom in jeopardy with the dragon. Ulrich sends his apprentice to lock away a magical amulet in the castle, all as part of a ruse, and then uses his magic to lock Galen within a tower to keep him from interfering with the test. He then submits to allowing Tyrion to test his true powers by letting the surly man run him through with an enchanted dagger. In spite of his apprentice's screams to stop, Tyrion stabs the old man as he's commanded, and shocks the group as Ulrich drops dead before them. Hodge and Galen sadly cremate their master and store his ashes in a leather pouch, with Hodge dejectedly noting that the final wish of Ulrich was to be scattered over flaming water. With nothing keeping him tied to Kraganmoor, Galen announces to Hodge that he will take up the challenge offered to Ehrlich to honor his master, and he will attempt to travel to Swanscombe in Erland to battle the dragon himself, much to the consternation of the elderly caretaker. Donning the crystal necklace of his master, Galen and Hodge end up catching up to the delegation and begin to travel with them. Now, over the course of their trek, Galen decides that he's going to bathe in a pool along with Valerian and discovers quite by accident that the young man is actually a young maiden in disguise, masquerading as a boy all these years to avoid the lottery established that the king provides to serve up virgins to the beast. Galen understands and promises to keep Valerian's secret between them. As he dresses from his bath, he experiences a vision of Tyrion shooting an arrow through the woods, and alarmed, he runs back to the camp, horrified to find that Hodge has been murdered by the guard as a deterrent to keep the group from continuing on with its mission to remove the dragon. Now enraged, Galen is even more determined to stop the beast, and upon arriving in Swanscombe, Galen brings down the mountainside over the lair of Vermithrax, seemingly trapping and killing the beast, much to the villagers' delight. Hailed as a hero, Galen's celebration is cut short, though, as Tyrion arrives and drags him to have an audience with King Cassiodorus, as played by Peter Airey, who doubts the young man's abilities, and instead confiscates the youth's magical amulet, and has him roughed up and thrown into the castle's dungeon. Cassiodorus' daughter, Princess Elspeth, as played by Chloe Salmon, goes to visit the young apprentice and is shocked when Galen tells her the truth about her father and how he actually conducts the lottery to choose victims for the beast.
Open up, my sir! Tell the holy dog what you like!
Go away, Magister Juvenalis. I've studied Latin. Greek, too. Mia Pelos, Elspeth, Filium Regis.
Filium Regis? You're his daughter.
Please don't think ill of us. Father is a wise and even-handed man. He's... What happened to you?
Nothing. Just some of the king's even-handedness.
It's better for everyone this way. A king must protect his people.
Naturally. Just as he protects his daughter.
What do you mean by that? Are you referring to the lottery?
You know about the lottery.
I have participated in every choosing since I came of age. The whole kingdom knows that.
You don't have to pretend. Not to me, not down here. Everyone knows how this choosing works. The families with money, royal connections. You participated in a lie, you know it.
I have to go now.
You know I'm right.
Wale, dormi bene.
As fate would have it, Vermithrax is not actually dead, and instead causes a tremendous earthquake as she frees herself from her lair, giving Galen a chance to escape his bondage with a little help from the princess. And it also allows the dragon to go on to raise the village of Swanscombe, but not before the faithful Brother Jacobus, as played by Ian McDiarmid, attempts to confront the beast himself, accusing it of being the devil and trying to drive it off with the purity of his faith. The confrontation ends tragically, and Vermithrax goes on to burn the village and surrounding fields in anger.
Listen to me, my brethren. The moment of our fear is the hour of our triumph. This is a sign from God. Horns, tail, wings, and clawed feet. This is no dragon. This is Lucifer.
Dear Father, we beseech thee, show us thy goodness, this evil makes. Show us thy power.
This world, the devil flung from heaven, will now rise from hell.
Unclean beast, get thee down! Be thou consumed by the fire that made thee!
Needing to once again placate the dragon with a new human sacrifice, the king calls for a new lottery, forcing the now outed as a woman Valerian to participate. The king himself, though, is horrified to find that Princess Elspeth, angered over her father's rigging of the lottery for so many years, has placed a fix of her own, and she has been chosen to be the next tribute for the dragon. Without anywhere to turn, Cassiodorus freely gives Galen his amulet back to help save his daughter from the dragon's fire. Needing a weapon, though, to challenge the monster with, Galen ends up working with Valerian's father, Simon, as played by Emrys James, the town blacksmith, to forge a magically enhanced spear, the Sicarius Dracorum, the Dragon Slayer, for his coming battle. Valerian, on her own, heads off to the blighted area outside of Vermithrax's lair, where she collects the creature's scales to fashion into a fireproof shield for Galen to use. Horrified, though, to learn that the dragon has offspring in its cavern. Fearing that Galen is just helping the king because he is in love with the princess, she is shocked when Galen reveals that he wishes to kill the beast so he can be with Valerian herself.
It's a shield. I made it. Might keep the fire off, you might not. You know, you're an idiot. You're going to die tonight. You'll be ripped limb from limb. This is the last time I'll ever speak to you.
Thank you.
Another thing. I've been up there. That thing isn't alone. It's got little ones. Young, I think. I don't know how many.
They'll have to be killed, too. Anything else?
You're in love, aren't you?
Yes.
It's all right. I understand. She's very beautiful. Very brave.
Who is? What do you mean?
Your princess. But I don't care. Listen to me, Galen Bradwarden, sorcerer's apprentice. You're going to be dead. The dragon will be worse than ever. There will be more lotteries. And I'm not a boy anymore.
And you'll be eligible
because I'm still a virgin.
That night, as the princess is chained outside of the dragon's lair, Galen arrives to free her and fight the beast, but he's met by Tyrion, who's trying to allow the sacrifice to go through to save the kingdom. The two end up fighting, and while Galen does kill the captain of the guard, Elspeth runs into the cave in an attempt to sacrifice herself anyway. Galen makes his way in and finds her being feasted upon by three young dragonettes, which he quickly kills before descending down into Vermithrax's lair. When he enters, he sees a full cavern before him, shocked that there's an underground burning lake of fire, and that's where he confronts the beast in direct combat. Galen does manage to wound the dragon, but his spear ends up breaking off in the animal's throat, causing him to be forced to retreat and ultimately pass out from exhaustion of batting away the dragon fire. Waking the next morning, Galen views hope as being lost, and Valerian convinces him to leave the kingdom with her, putting the dragon and the lottery behind them. As he's preparing to leave, Ulrich's amulet begins to glow, and Galen begins to put together his final task, remembering Hodge's statement about the master wanting his ashes to be spread over burning water. He instantly recalls the lake in the dragon's lair and realizes that Ulrich had planned this all along. He was too old to make the journey himself, and he knew his ashes could be carried to Erland by Galen and Hodge. Galen and Valerian quickly return back to the dragon's lair when Vermithrax is gone and end up spreading the ashes across the lake, bringing Ulrich back to the world of the living.
You're back. I thank the powers that made me.
Glad to see you too. You didn't bring along anything to eat by any chance?
Food?
But come along. There's much to do.
No, please. I thought I was a sorcerer. I'm not. I thought I had power. I don't. You said to be strong. I wasn't.
But you were, my boy. You were. And you'll be stronger yet.
After being resurrected, Ulrich instructs Galen that he will engage the dragon in battle. And once the time is right, the young man will have to destroy the amulet. Galen promises his master that he will follow through. And the wizard ascends to a peak and conjures a storm, drawing Vermithrax to him and injuring the beast from a distance with lightning blasts, while being forced to weather blasts of dragonfire himself. Vermithrax ends up snatching Ulrich up in its claws and carries the sorcerer high into the sky. Looking down on Galen, the youth does keep his promise, and he smashes the amulet with a rock, causing a cataclysmic explosion within Ulrich's own body, killing both him and the dragon for good. In the morning, the villagers gather around the smoking corpse of the beast, some proclaiming that it's a divine work of the Christian God who saved them, that is, until the king arrives and takes credit for the creature's defeat himself. Disgusted, Galen and Valerian begin their journey together to leave Swanscombe and the kingdom of Erland altogether. Acknowledging that he misses the old man and the powerful amulet, to Valerian, Galen ends up looking back to the village below and opines that All he really wishes is they had a horse, only to have a white steed suddenly appear, which hints that Galen still has his magical powers as the two ride off into the sunny horizon. Credits. Roll. Now, where do we even begin? Well, let's talk about some of our actors here first, starting with Peter McNichol. Now, I'll tell you, I like Peter McNichol. I grew up watching him in this film. It's the first thing I ever saw him be in. But I do have a problem wrapping my head around him being a hero. Again, don't get me wrong, he's in no way bad here. He's good. But I have this sort of accumulated celluloid mileage that have built up over the years of seeing him play these soft, weak men, a la Sophie's Choice, or conversely, see him playing completely goofy characters, showing up in things like Ghostbusters 2 or Dracula Dead and Loving It, or hell, even his stint on Ally McBeal. So knowing that, to see him pick up a spear and challenge somebody to a fight, and then go on to fight a monster, it just kind of messes with my brain. That said, he's completely serviceable, and this is a good time for him. As for Ralph Richardson, watching him on screen here is a pleasure as always, but for me, I wish I could have gotten a little bit more out of him. The novelization of Dragonslayer gives Ulrich far more insight, backstory, and an understanding of the choices that he makes, which gives us a more complete character. And I think Richardson really could have taken that version of the Sorcerer out for a walk, but instead, to fit the needs of an already 100-plus-minute movie, we sort of just get what we get, and that's a little disappointing. Caitlin Clark is gorgeous as always, but she too gets cheated with the truncation of the script. As a character, Valerian falling in love with Galen makes far more sense if you were to put into the context of the original script, where Galen arrives right after the spring equinox sacrifice has taken place, and then he seals Vermithrax's cave up, and he's forced by the king and the guards to stick around to wait and see what's going to happen, which he happily agrees to do so, and thus he comes to know the people in the community, makes friends, bonds with the blacksmith, and has a proper friendship and romance with Valerian over the course of what is 6 months. I understand, again, the need to keep the story rolling, but when you watch it as an adult, it looks really bizarre, because she seems to publicly expose her, air quotes, true gender to the village, and then seems to be the next day immediately in love with the sorcerer's apprentice. Ian McDiarmid is marvelous as the frothing-at-the-mouth early Christian, but I wouldn't expect anything less from him. But truthfully, for my money, the really interesting and subtle character to watch here is actually Hallam playing Tyrion, if for nothing else, with the cold pragmatism he seems to bring to the character. Yeah, in theory he's ostensibly the human villain who gives us an alternate to the dragon, but like all good villains, he sees himself as a hero. Look at the situation from his point of view. You have this group of locals who don't like the deal the king has made with a monster, so they set out to try to bring back a champion to kill the beast, ignoring the very real fact that if at any point their plan fails, the village is going to get burned, people are going to die, and the entire kingdom is going to be plunged further into darkness. Is he a jerk about it? Oh, most assuredly. But he's thinking about the entirety of the kingdom of Erland with his actions, not just the village of Swanscombe. So when he goes to suggest his test of Ulrich, and then when he does what the wizard tells him to do, in his mind, he just keeps confirming to himself he's dealing with a bunch of amateurs, and they're going to get them all killed. And he has no problem telling them that.
Tyrion.
Good morrow, all.
What do you want?
Young Master Valerian, question is, what do you want so far from home?
We're not afraid of you. Give us the road.
Why, the road is yours. All the way to Erland. It's a long journey, isn't it? But when you're in search of a sorcerer, I suppose no distance is too great.
Say nothing. And here,
We have the mystical presence himself.
You best keep your distance. And your manners.
If he's ready to lay a dragon in its grave, he's nothing to fear from me. I've no more love for that creature than you lot. Nor has the king. But before you stir things up, don't you think it would be a good idea to find out if you've got the right man for the job?
Ah, so it's a test you're looking for. We don't do tests.
I'm sure you don't. They never do tests. Not many real deeds either. Oh, conversation with your grandmother's shade in a darkened room, the odd love potion or two, but comes a doubter. Why, then it's the wrong day. The planets are not in line. The entrails are not favorable. We don't do tests.
We've got no doubts. We require no tests.
And you're not going to get one.
Enough.
So, does it really come as any surprise when a very real-life example of fuck around and find out occurs? When Tyrion's warning gets ignored, he simply kills Hodge on the road. Again, to show his seriousness that he's not kidding, don't mess with the people in the kingdom. And at the end, when the dragon is revealed to not be dead, when he burns the village, when he kills a bunch of people, the events transpire that he warned everybody about. When Tyrion goes to make his last stand to make sure the princess is properly sacrificed to stop the slaughter, truthfully, he does seem like the most level-headed person, because he told everyone, and it's come true, which again reinforces his point of view that it's him who's saving the kingdom, not Galen.
I knew I'd find you here. Well, I'm not as sentimental as His Majesty. The kingdom, every one of us, needs this sacrifice. If you intend to interfere, you'll have to kill me.
I've plenty of reasons to kill you that have nothing to do with this sacrifice.
Most impressive. Can you use it?
No! Stop! Tyrion is right! This is our only hope!
I suppose, though, the most obvious reason anyone should go to see this film, Vermithrax Pejorative herself. In an age where anything can be done with CGI, watching this film even now, the dragon is wildly impressive. It moves like one would expect an animal of that size and shape to actually do so, while still appearing to be grounded in very real physics. While director Robbins wisely chose not to show the beast directly until Galen had his one-on-one confrontation, even the little glimpses we get, the massive claws drifting into frame, the back of its horned head as it rises out of its subterranean lair, its victims, like when Jacobus is looking up at it, just seeing the beast's point of view, it all gives this added layer of mystique, and it just speaks to the creature's massive size. Again, I get it. It makes sense. You hide the monster until you want to have your big reveal moment. And again, due to issues that they had making the dragon work, it's a great workaround. But in this case, it so pays off when we finally get to have that confrontation on the Lake of Fire. I have to say this too. One of the aspects I really enjoy and find interesting is the subtlety that Dragon Slayer shows towards the shifting from an age of magic and fantasy to an age of feudalism, and the use of a new religion as a control mechanism in a burgeoning medieval Europe. Galen does indeed help accomplish his master's final task, and it comes at the cost of everything that he has ever known and trained for. Think of it, by the time our story has wrapped, he's lost his teacher and his family, both with the loss and death of Ulrich and Hodge, and he finds himself out of a job. He's dealing with a kingdom that views him now as completely irrelevant once the threat's been removed. we, the audience, can take some solace that we know he's going to ride off and have what seems to be an apparent happy ending, leaving with Valerian, the woman he loves, on a white horse, going into some kind of future together. And yeah, perhaps they will head back to Cragganmore, make the castle their own. But there's an unmistakable undertone seen here, as the film grapples with the very real issue that magic, at least apparently as this time has always known it, is dead. Sure, Galen can use it, but it's not likely we're going to see any more sorcerers cropping up anytime soon. It's both a happy and somewhat bleak ending that it offers us, and it sets up sort of an interesting future struggle for the kingdom itself. I do enjoy that Greal, after taking up the mantle of the religious leader in town after the death of Brother Jacobus, he publicly proclaims that it's the new Christian god who's delivered them from the dragon, only to have King Cassiodorus roll up and declare himself divinely inspired to be the champion for his people, and after weakly thrusting his sword into what's left of Vermithrax's smoldering corpse, he proclaims himself to be the true slayer of the beast, all while Greal and the peasants look on, somewhat perturbed, but still cowed. From the standpoint of the king, he no longer has to contend with would-be wizards or monstrous worms. Even though he's lost a daughter, a new era has clearly dawned. He's the future. He's modernity. And as we've seen it by way of his decision-making process throughout the film, the path the kingdom finds itself on is going to be still a dark and treacherous one, but now for far different reasons. Because the king is a man interested in gold and power, and he sees the people as being beneath him, and that's only slightly hinted at in the film. When you read the script and the novelization, where all of our characters understandably are given more backstory, Cassiodorus is technically a noble because he descended from a long line of Roman-appointed warlords who had conquered this part of northern England and were just left in charge after the Gauls sacked Rome in the early 400s. So if we're to believe that Swanscombe's location, which is by the River Ur, hence why it's in the Kingdom of Erland, it means we are seeing this story take place in what would be modern North Yorkshire? So his open disdain for all these Saxon peasants makes a lot more sense, and he sees that it's his family that's been ruling them for the past two centuries. I love that Vermithrax is the villain, but truly, Cassiodorus is the real bad guy here, because he's completely willing to sell out his kingdom to a monster just to maintain his position of control. And honestly, what greater evil exists than the banality of living next to something so horrific and not even attempting to stop it? So I can hear you out there, though. Chris, how was the movie received? Well, honestly, people didn't quite know what to make of it. Critically, the reception to the picture was sort of mixed when it came to the story. But when it came to the dragon, all the critics would agree they got their money's worth. Roger Ebert, frequent punching bag of mine, really liked the movie, stating that this film offered one of the more convincing Dark Ages, at least more than Borman's Excalibur, and he noted that the hero's portrayal by McNichol and Clark just felt right. He went on stating that here's a movie that has a courage to be grungy. Dragons live in a smelly lair deep beneath a crumbling mountain, and to reach them you have to cross a lake of fire and somehow avoid being eaten alive by little baby dragons. But again, I don't like doing this. I gotta give Ebert credit where it's due. He was one of the few reviewers at the time who just recognized the straight-up awesomeness that was Vermithrax, noting that the scenes involving the dragon are all first-rate. This beast is one of the meanest, ugliest, most reprehensible creatures I've seen on film, and when it breathes flames, it looks like it's really breathing flames. Now, Ebert wasn't the only one that pointed that out. Kevin Thomas of the LA Times doubled down and wrote, "Forget Godzilla, forget all of the other dinosaurs and fire breathers, and make way for the greatest dragon yet. The wondrously scary Vermithrax pejorative, the terror of 6th century British Kingdom of Erland." Janet Maslin of the New York Times was a little more guarded, spoke well of the film and the technical aspects, but she didn't seem to care for the dark undertones. She stated in her review that, well, there you have it, it's part monster movie, part love story, part magical fable, but these elements don't mesh particularly well, and the film tends to move in fits and starts as it tries to force them together. Although Dragon Slayer needs romance and adventure, it might have been better off without its world-weary overview, a fairy tale innocence of a film's most ingratiating feature, and it needn't be compromised. Right. Right. Okay, because when I think back on the fairy tales I read when I was a kid, like, you know, Grimm's fairy tales, they're nothing but sugar and spice. You know, those stories, like the one Little Hans who told a lie and then he had his thumbs cut off. Great stuff, yeah. Rolling Stone, though, wasn't much better. Reviewer Michael Sarago opined that the writers Barwood and director Robbins were clear Tolkien fans and true fantasy believers, as if that's a bad thing, stating that Dragon Slayer never transcends its progenitors, noting that it's been made according to a Tolkien recipe with, you know, a few fresh ingredients. But honestly, the most shocking part of his review is his complaint that Ulrich's Latin spells are as archaic as the dragon's dinosaur appearance. That shocks me because, A, what better time to assume you would be hearing someone read and speak Latin than during the Dark Ages, and B, do you not have eyes? This dragon is tits. What the hell are you looking at? I digress. In the end, though, audiences didn't seem to hate the film. Rather, when Dragon Slayer opened up to a national release on June 26, 1981, it opened with some steep competition. It was going head-to-head that weekend alone with the latest Bond offering, For Your Eyes Only, Bill Murray's comedy Stripes, the family movie The Great Muppet Caper, excellent film, the Cannonball Run film, and all of these movies were put in their place because this was the second week that Superman 2 was in theaters. So with all of those options for film-going families, Dragon Slayer, with its dark fare and technical prowess, got lost in the shuffle rather quickly in the summer of 1981. It also didn't help that Disney, not immediately seeing the profits that they wanted, were rather quick to dump their portion of promoting the film with Paramount, and would thus end up writing the film off as a loss that year, not seeing a full return on their investment. Dragon Slayer would go on to only gross $14 million against its original $18 million budget. Although interestingly, Dragon Slayer, in spite of its lackluster box office performance, would wind up being nominated that following year for not one but two Academy Awards, both for Best Visual Effects and for composer Alex North's Best Original Score. For the music, North would end up losing out to Vangelis for Chariots of Fire. Yeah, I get it. But ironically, when it was up for the Best Visual Effects, it would lose its award to Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is a riot because the same effects team did both of those films, so that meant the ILM staff were competing against themselves. That at least had to have felt good for those guys. That said, as the years rolled on, Dragon Slayer continued to collect fans, both in public and in business. You see, it's a cult movie that earned some well-deserved buzz as a video cassette rental, and then amongst industry fans who were in the know. You know, people like author George R.R. Martin, directors Guillermo del Toro and Neil Marshall, who all let their love of Vermithrax color their own works. You would not have the dragons in Reign of Fire, the game Skyrim, or Game of Thrones without the influence of this film. And that's a testament to the quality of the work that ILM did, and that of Barwood and Robbins. For my money, you don't get much better than this when it comes to having a simple yet delightfully dark tale, and real fans of fantasy should be running out to acquaint themselves with this as fast as possible if they've never seen it. For me, honestly, I look forward to the coming day when I can return the favor and I can sit my nephews down right here at the LSCE Theater. I can hand them each a big bowl of popcorn, maybe share a pop, and with any luck, I can continue the tradition of dazzling them with a really phenomenal-looking dragon in a really fun film. But that, that's going to be a tale for another day. The version of Dragon Slayer screened here at the LSCE was the 2003 Standard Edition DVD release that was put out through Paramount. And it came completely bare bones, bereft of any special features, save for subtitles. Now, that version is still floating out and about in the wild. You can find it for a very inflated $20 a throw, but I have to say, there's been a newer release that appeared in 2017, and truth be told, it's got different cover art, but it's the same disc, the same offering, the same lack of content, but just by buying that newer version of the DVD, it retails for $5.99 on Amazon.com, which I would say for this film is a shockingly fair price. But for you guys holding out hope for special features, not all is lost, because A, if you have Paramount Plus, Dragon Slayer, which has just recently gone off, but it's part of the rotation, it's a free film that you can screen from the Paramount archives, so it will be coming back again this spring. But if you're like me, B, you're going to be over the moon with the announcement that this March of 2023 is going to see for the first time a proper Blu-ray release from Paramount and Disney of an honest-to-goodness version of Dragon Slayer with special features. Features that are going to include commentary tracks from director Matthew Robbins and superfan director Guillermo del Toro, the original screen tests of the actors, and a six-part making-of documentary entitled The Slayer of All Dragons. And all of this can be yours, pre-ordered, for $17.99 on Amazon.com, which I would tell you is well worth the money, and what's more, I've already pre-ordered my copy. Now, remember folks, we here at the LSCE don't get anything for telling you where to purchase your films from. We just think in this day and age, it's really ever so important to keep supporting physical media, to ensure that these fine companies who own the rights to these amazing films will keep releasing the content that we all know and love. And at the end of the day, isn't that really what it's all about? Getting more of what you know and love? But besides that, Dragon Slayer truly is a technical marvel, it's a rollicking adventure, and it's a delightful bit of dark fantasy, which begs the question, what are you waiting for? Go out there, get yourself a copy of Dragon Slayer today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you for joining us. It's good to be back. We do hope you'll be back with us next week and continue to enjoy Here There Be Dragons as the month rolls on with another favorite of mine, the film The Flight of Dragons. So be sure to join us then. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Dachshunds and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here, give you a shout out on the show. Think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Like this one. This was left by Half-Priced Horror, entitled So Informative. A meticulously researched and always fascinating look at movies that don't get a ton of attention. Chris finds some very weird and interesting movies, and he does a great job bringing them to life for his audience and encouraging one of my priorities, physical media. Wow. First, thank you so much. I can't tell you how touched that makes me. And yes, clearly, Half-Priced Horror media is, oh, such a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I have to say, it's like we said when we were talking about Paramount Plus moving Dragon Slayer from its queue. It will put it back, but what if you wanted to watch it right now? You having that bit of physical media means you control when you watch it, not when some company does or when rights decide to lapse. You own it, lock, stock, and barrel. It's yours. It'll always be there. So, clearly, Half-Price, you're a person of refined habit and taste, and physical media is indeed, as always, where it's at. So, all that said, see folks, it's just that easy. Leave a review, have me give you a shout-out right here. And if nothing else, please, swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. We've been added to Stitcher, so you can find us there, give us a spin if you like. I'm proud to say we're on Amazon Music. If you have an account, you can simply say out loud, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured both on Good Pods and on Podchaser. Those are marvelous podcast databases for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and review if you could please, and hey, feel free to like any of the lists that we're a part of to give us a boost in the old rankings. We're also on Spotify, listen there if you like. But keep in mind, the more reviews, the increased likes, that affects all of those marvelous algorithms and it makes us more searchable. And then we can share more films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! Do you have any questions for us? Any comments? Any movies you want us to cover? Anything you think I got wrong? We'd love to hear from you. Please send us an email or an audio clip by way of lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. Do you use social media? Well, we got it here. You can follow us on Twitter at LSCEP, or you can find us on Instagram at LSCE_podcast. If you'd like to be even more personable or wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, feel free, send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So, until next time, please everybody, take care out there. Wash your hands. Wear a mask if you feel like it, but please, most importantly, everybody, stay healthy and well. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.